to order. And this morning, or this afternoon, I should say, we have as our sole presenter Dr. John Burke, who is an associate professor of medicine and chief division of gastroenterology, director of gastroenterology hepatology fellowship program at UConn. And I believe that he was recommended by Senator Witkos, but nevertheless, we are honored to have him today as one of our Connecticut's finest at UConn. Just a couple of housekeeping things before we turn it over to the doctor. I understand that Richard Mahoney, Representative Lou Esposito, and possibly Senator Witkos will not be able to make it. The senator may come in at the tail end. However, we are taping, I believe, so we can make it available as we did the last meeting. And we also have a fine handout that the doctor has provided to us. Also, we've decided to cancel next week's meeting for a couple of reasons. One is there have been no further individuals offered as witnesses for that meeting. Secondly, a number of the legislators, we are up for re-election, and we want to allow everybody as much time as they can to campaign and do what they have to do. And hopefully it will give us all an opportunity to pause and just review all the testimony, reflect on it, and the co-chairs will be meeting during that interim to try and make an assessment of where we are, and hopefully we'll hear some input from all of you. And as we have encouraged you throughout the process, we have heard from a lot of witnesses, but if you feel there is somebody else that won't duplicate what we've heard, that can add or embellish on some of the testimony, we certainly would encourage you to let us know if there are any other witnesses, and we will go from there. So before I turn it over, let me ask my co-chair if you would like to remark.
First of all, David, welcome back, and our condolences, as you well know. I'm just thrilled that we've been able to use our premier university. We had Dr. Bruckner last week, and now we have Dr. Burke, and I think I saw Joanne, to thank her for navigating the faculty and bringing these great professors for us. And also, I hope that Senator Witkos does get here, because it was a terrific suggestion when we started talking about what happens in the digestive tract and where do these things end up and how fast are they expelled, et cetera, to go down this road. So I'm thrilled to have you here, Dr. Burke, and I'm also thrilled that we share SUNY at Stony Brook, and we could tell stories forever, but welcome, and we're looking forward to hearing your presentation.
With that, I will turn the floor over to Dr. Burke, and I understand you'll be doing the slide projection at the same time. And I would suggest we let the doctor complete his presentation, and then we'll obviously have time for questions. Thank you very much.
Well, first I want to thank the committee and the members for allowing me to speak, and I feel a little bit privileged to even be here. So I want to thank you all for that. My presentation today won't take long, but feel free if you have questions or concerns, to ask them and frame them when I finish, I guess, because she's fine with me. But you can interrupt, too. It's a relatively short one. As said, I am kind of my outline of what I'm going to talk about today was I'm going to frame who I am and how I can sort of help with your task force. I'm going to explain a little bit about the pathology and the timing of foreign body ingestion as it goes through the GI tract in a human. And I have quite a bit of expertise in that, which I can answer any questions on. I'll also explain some of the anatomical landmarks that catch foreign body ingestions, and I'll go through some of the techniques of removal and therapy on that, and then I'll discuss some of the common things that I've seen and have been reported in the literature that get ingested and the toxicities of them in general. So just sort of give you a general overhaul of what is ingested and the problems associated with that. And then I'll talk a little bit about the therapy, which is basically what I do, and I certainly can answer questions and have quite a bit of expertise in that. Okay, so overall, I'm a clinical adult gastroenterologist. I have limited experience in toxic pharmacology, and my specific point is cadmium I've heard of, and I'm not even sure if I know it on the periodic elements, but I know it's bad. Okay. It's bad. I think it's bad. Anyway, but I do have a lot of expertise in soft foreign body ingestion, and I slipped there saying mainly a lot of foreign body ingestions wind up being esophageal foreign bodies at the real number one check points. And then the different substance compounds and the age differences in that. So let's talk a little bit about normal ingestion. I have a little homunculus after this little cartoon. But under normal circumstances, when a food bolus is ingested, it rapidly transmits through the esophagus. Rapidly means less than a minute. Okay. Once food enters into the stomach, stomach emptying is a little slower, as we all know. And the rule that we run around with is saying that a solid meal ingests about 50% in 1 hour, and about 80 to 90% in 2 hours. And that's actually the philosophy behind when they tell you, about surgery and things like that, when they make you wait for a while for the surgery, because the assumption is they don't want you to aspirate during induction and the intubation. And then small bowel transit is uniformly, in most people, about 90 minutes or about an hour and a half. And then colonic transit can be anywhere from 24 to 48 hours. Now, in some patients, it's a little slower. That's really based on your hydration status and the compounds you're eating. You know, high-fiber diet, well-hydrated, it might be even less than 24 hours. You know, low-fiber diet, where the stool gets a little bit compacted more, and you tend to run dehydrated, it could be as long as, out as far as 5 to 7 days. But the number we like to use is 24 to 48 hours. So that sort of frames that this is kind of the exposure time of any foreign body as it goes through, if it's going to pass. And here we have a little homunculus that we can just sort of review this again. Okay, so you hopefully chew what you're eating, and then it goes down the esophagus relatively rapidly. It stays in the stomach here for, as I mentioned, 80-90% of the time it empties out. And I want to point your attention to this sort of thing we call the C-loop, which is the duodenum, which is the first part of the small bowel, the small intestine. The reason why that's sort of important is, as you can see, it's got a couple of turns in it, the C-turns. And that's where we're talking about not so much the diameter of the substance of foreign body ingestion, but as far as the length of things. And as we mentioned later on, the length beyond 5 centimeters or a little bit more than 2 inches can get stuck in there, so we tend to remove them, and they tend to sit in the stomach and not move. And then the other sort of anatomical point that we talk about is the 2.5 centimeter rule, or the size of a quarter, which actually things will not pass through the stomach or the stomach connecting to the small bowel, which is called the pylorus. So that's another thing. So things you might be able to get down your esophagus that are long, such as, let's say, a pen or something, dentures or a toothpick or something. You might get it down your esophagus as a straight shot, but it'll sit in the stomach because it won't be able to pass through the C-loop and go into the small bowel. Or something that's too big and bulky in your esophagus might be able to pass something up to 3 inches in size. Won't be 3 centimeters, inches, 3 centimeters, but won't be able to pass through the pyloric channel. So that's the other sort of size constraint here. But once we go through the small bowel, that'll take about 90 minutes. Occasionally something, and actually in children this is more common, occasionally something will get stuck here at the bottom of the small bowel called the ileocecal valve. kind of a T intersection you can see. That occasionally becomes a problem with things like marbles and buttons and things that actually have gotten that far, because that's a narrow and small vowel. And then once it pops into the colon, it's usually pretty much home free. The issue there is in people like drug smugglers who, you know, with cocaine packing and that. That's the risk of, because it's hung up there for a day or two, or the risk of bursting and breaking, and mortality rate in that is pretty high. So that's the concern with the with lesions in the colon. And it goes across here. It's a cutout. This is what I borrowed from the Mayo Clinic. That's the transverse colon. This is the right colon, or the ascending colon, on the right side of the body. This is the left colon, or descending colon, on the left side of the body. Here's our sigmoid, and then it goes down into the rectum. And the rectum is really a storage vesicle before you get that urge to go, and then it comes out. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the catch points of foreign bodies. One of the catch points is the upper esophagus and the lower esophagus. Like I mentioned, that tends to be this sort of funnel of where things get stuck. Commonly, things that get stuck in the upper esophagus are really relate to elderly patients. Things like dentures, believe it or not, knives, forks, utensils. Sometimes, and I don't even mean so much that you swallow the whole thing. It's like, I think maybe all of us have experienced this, where you have like a plastic fork, and you're like eating with the plastic fork, and a piece of the plastic fork breaks off, or even the thing snaps in half, and you by accident swallow it, or a denture can swallow, or you have a toothpick in your mouth, and you can swallow that. There's all these kind of misadventures. A bigger bone, I mean, this happens. This is life, you know, this is what happens, you know. Fish bones, those are the kinds of things that get stuck up here in the upper esophagus. They really don't get by because they're kind of bulky and get stuck. Now, in the lower esophagus, hot dog. yes, I should have hot dog stuck in the upper esophagus. In the lower esophagus, because the guy was like going like this, yes, eating the whole thing at once. Which is not smart, but nevertheless happens. I thought you mentioned it. I'm following your lead. The other thing is the lower esophagus. And the lower esophagus tends to be more food, more middle-aged people. And the classic thing is something called the porterhouse steak syndrome. And that's where you have a big piece of meat, you swallow it, you didn't chew it fully, and it gets stuck in these, in the bottom of the esophagus in strictures or rings that occur from chronic reflux disease. And that's kind of a classic thing. And I would say that's the number one thing I get called in at night to remove. And the safe thing to do is actually not remove them, just push them through to the stomach, because they're not really stuck tight, and there are food, and the assumption is they'll just get digested and passed. So that's a very, very common late-night crawl for someone like myself, and a very common foreign body in the sense that it's not really foreign body, it's food, but it's kind of stuck and hung up. And once you get it beyond that point, then you're okay. Now, in the stomach, as I was mentioning before, there's all these things that won't pass, that you can get through the esophagus but won't pass the stomach. And that might be a little bit more germane to this group is perhaps when we talk about jewelry and the cadmium story, but such things as coins. Coins are the most common thing that children swallow, by the way. Pens, as I mentioned, because people, you know, the way that people kind of pens in their mouth and they're thinking, and I don't know how, but somehow they swallow them. Toothbrushes, brushing your teeth, or it breaks off a piece of it. And any other long, narrow objects. Straw is another example of that. Okay? And then our real concern is, okay, these are stomach objects, which usually you can get a history on. In children, however, you can't always get a history on whether or not they've passed. But in the small bowel, the things that you worry about a little bit are such things as buttons and batteries, and the button batteries. For some reason, children have a predilection for liking to swallow batteries. I guess the way they look, they're shiny, they're small, even more so than regular buttons and marbles. They like button batteries. And that's quite a problem because, you know, batteries contain mercury and they don't usually survive the transit time of the GI tract and they have to be removed. A button battery ingestion is a big deal in a child. And like I said, I mentioned that the buttons, although can pass through the pylorus, in children, they can get stuck at that terminal ileum at the bottom of the small bowel, which also requires... The problem with the foreign objects that are stuck in that terminal ileum is that almost requires a surgery to take out. It's not something I can reach with an endoscope. So it's a fairly significant problem. And then, as I mentioned, the big thing about esophageal foreign or foreign body ingestion in the colon are these body packers or drug smugglers. If one of those cocaine packets burst, it's well reported in the literature that that's nearly a 30% mortality rate. It's pretty deadly. It's worrisome. Anyway, okay. So these are kind of going through the ingestion items that need removal and consideration for you guys. Is quarters need to be removed, even in adults. They're just a little too big to sort of expect transit for. Pennies, dimes, and nickels are small enough to pass. And that's generally true for children, too. Buttons, marbles, toys often need removal if greater than 2.5 centimeters. I was just talking to the industry representative who happened to be sitting in here, and he told me that that's one of their criteria for toys they make, is that size, and I'm in agreement with that. And as I mentioned, all batteries need to be removed because of the leakage of toxic elements, which is germane to here. There's nickel, there's mercury. I'm not sure if cadmium's in batteries. And then most sharp objects and objects longer than 6 centimeters need to be removed because, as I mentioned, they can't get around that C loop and they get stuck. Okay. So what do we do about this stuff? Well, the first thing I want to sort of, a couple takeaway points from my session here in the committee is that most objects pass on their own. That's the first thing to remember. Most things that you can swallow and get into your stomach will pass on their own. In more recent studies, they've been more forgiving about letting things pass than in the past. I think we were more aggressive in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and the more recent literature suggests that you can let things pass or sit on things and wait for them to pass more so. You know, if they make those criteria size and sharpness, that's and not being a button battery, you can wait. Watchful waiting is pretty reasonable. Therapeutic option. However, if something sits in the stomach for more than 10 days, and what you do is you bring, once you have the history of this, you bring the child back, you bring the adult back, and do x-rays on them every 2 or 3 days and see if it's passed through the stomach, if it's something that you think can go, can be passed. And then eventually, if it's not passed, then you go back and you get it. Something that sits in the esophagus is really more of an emergency because the esophagus doesn't have a great blood supply, and this thing is pressing up against it, and there's a risk of perforation. The main risk of all of these foreign body things are the risk of them getting stuck, and then the tissue where they get stuck causes ischemia or bad blood flow, and then you perforate from it. And also, that's the risk of removing it, but that's always the big risk with this. Okay? And then, obviously, the treatment of choice it's endoscopy. It's less invasive. I'm going to call it non-invasive, but it doesn't involve incision and post-op time and major surgery. So endoscopy is probably the smartest way to go to remove most of these objects, if needed. But my sort of real take-home point for the committee is that most things pass, and most things pass in 2 or 3 days. That's my point. And then there's a few correlators and a few things that don't. Okay. So these are the tools that I use to remove it. This thing here on the right is called the rat tooth forceps. And see, it has these sharp teeth, and you can grab onto things and sort of hold on to it. Then on the other side here, there's what we call a Roth nest or a snare basket, and we kind of lasso it inside the basket and then close the basket around it. And then we pull it out through the esophagus. Now the thing in the middle here is kind of the key thing that was developed. The more advanced version was probably about 10 years old, and that's called an overtube. Now the function of the overtube is you put the endoscope inside it, and you put the overtube through the mouth. The patient's obviously asleep, and then you put it down into the esophagus. And that way it protects the oral pharynx in the top of the esophagus, so that when you remove this foreign object. You don't damage or traumatize through this sort of sharp 90-degree angle and difficult to navigate. So it's really kind of revolutionized our ability to take these things out, where it was always a sort of a difficult, challenging, and somewhat dangerous procedure. I mean, the literature quotes, although I don't see big studies on this, that the perforation rate of a foreign body ingestion removal is about 5%. So that's like 1 out of 20, which is pretty high. The other sort of statistic I want to sort of throw out there, although I couldn't see it well documented, and that's why I didn't put it in my handout, was that the reported reported foreign body ingestion mortality or death in the U.S. is estimated to be about 1,500 per year. And that's overall with everything. Okay. So we sort of went through this. 80% ingestion. I kind of went through that take-home point. Certain foreign bodies need removal. Batteries would be the big ones. Long objects, sharp objects, pins, needles, that kind of stuff. You know, roofers put nails in their mouth, and sometimes they swallow them. I tend to take those out. The seamstresses will put needles in their mouth. You know, they're sewing. I tend to take those out too. They sit in the stomach for a little while, and I tend not to wait until they remove. They can bury themselves in the tissue. Those are the kind of things that, when I say sharp objects, we take out. And then endoscopy, I feel, is the best way to remove these, and for obvious reasons that we just went over. So I know it was a brief presentation, but I wanted to frame my expertise, which I think hopefully will help you guys, sit through the stuff you need to know. So I'm open to questions if you have any.
Thank you very much, Doctor. We'll begin with my co-chair for questions, and then we'll work our way around.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. I think probably to just give you an idea of our concern and why Senator Witkos asked for this is we are trying to ascertain whether there is a safe level of cadmium in children's jewelry. And one of the issues was how long will a piece of cadmium lace jewelry ingested stay within the child's intestinal tract? And one of the questions that was related to that was we had found that when the jewelry was distressed, that it sheds sheds cadmium more than it would when it's not distressed. And realizing that children chew on jewelry and stomp around and do things, we're assuming that we would want to know when the jewelry's distressed, how long is it possible that it will be in the child's intestinal tract and available for absorption. So I would just say that when your colleague was here, he indicated that the half-life of cadmium is 30 years. So if it is absorbed into the child's body, it's half of it's gone in 30 years. So that's a thing of concern. And he also instructed us that it can displace zinc because they're very close together on the periodic chart in enzymes in activating them, and it can displace calcium in bones, and it can interfere with the uptake of copper and zinc. And the effect of that can be, and is, kidney failure, cardiovascular disease, obviously endocrine disruptor, a hormone disruptor, and bone embrittlement. And he did point out to us that in Japan they actually have a name for fatal cadmium poisoning, which is, and I don't know how you say it in Japanese, but it looks like itai to me. So we're very concerned, knowing that cadmium is toxic, and knowing that there's testing on this jewelry. However, there is no federal level of testing on jewelry. There is on toys. And there is a standard that has been promulgated by the industry. And that standard does not take into account how long the piece of jewelry might be in the child's system. So my question would be, there's a pretty vast time span when you think that It can be 10 days, but something ends up staying somewhere for 10 days. If it passes through immediately, it looks like it's hours till it gets to the intestines, and then it's maybe a day or two before it's actually expelled. So I guess, A, is a child's body different? And you also said that it depended upon what the person was eating, whether they were well hydrated and they were eating fiber. And so if you could be a little more specific on the differences with that. And then I guess if you are able to speak to, is the absorption only going to take place in the stomach? Or once that cadmium has been shed, in the stomach because it's a piece of distressed jewelry, I'm assuming that the absorption will take place all throughout the system. Is that sort of clear?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. I'll answer the first question about the transit time question. And the transit time question is in children. Children tend to have a little bit quicker transit time than us, so I would expect the 1 to 2 day rule to kind of hold true for children, despite their hydration and fiber content in the meals. They just tend to move a little quicker than us, so I think 7 to 10 days would be quite an outlier. Now, taking that into consideration, the other part of your sort of question is, well, how much time do we have for exposure to this distressed jewelry or this jewelry? And the presumption here is that the cadmium jewelry is ingested. It gets distressed by the acid in the stomach, okay? And then it gets presented to the small bowel. A toxic compound like cadmium, I would expect it to be, I think you have to make the assumption is, yes, most compounds are absorbed in the small bowel. The stomach is really a processing plant for the small bowel. It has acid, it has a grinding action, it has something called Ruby where it grinds up the food and then presents it to the small bowel. And the small bowel's real function is the absorption of nutrients, minerals, and the like. So I think that 90-minute transit time is the real absorption time. But however, when you talk about like something like a toxic substance, and that's really where you're at the biggest risk of absorbing something in that time frame. I think that when you talk about absorption in the stomach or the colon, where the two other areas are, there's not that much absorption going on. But the promise is that it's a toxic thing, and I'm not a chemist to sort of relate to this, but you have a very low level in your body, and then there's an equilibrium going on here. So there's probably some absorption going on in the stomach. I would say the greatest would be going on in the small bowel, where the small bowel is adapted to it, and then potentially some going on in the colon. I don't think it's so much an issue, representative, in normal transit, although I couldn't tell you how much is absorbed in a short few day period, a 2 to 3 day transit of a child. What I think the real sort of thing you have to think about is how often will this jewelry get stuck or sit in the stomach, or that's the issue, because I know that the case that Joanne told me about before was a case where something got stuck. And that's where it's kind of like the battery story about the longer the exposure time is when you sort of worry about that. And that's kind of the issue of how often does one of these pieces get absorbed or gets ingested and then get stuck for a while, maybe in the stomach, maybe in the colon, and then that would be my worry about sort of allowing or framing the idea of when the toxic setup could occur. Yes, I'm aware of the Japanese story, but it's in almost everything they eat. Their cadmium, it's in everything. And so they're constantly exposed to it. It's kind of like lead workers in a battery plant. And that's it. Here we're talking about a smaller, a one-time sort of ingestion, which could potentially lead to a problem. And I don't really have an answer for you on that, other than that I just don't have an answer. I can only tell you. That's you guys got to decide.
Yeah, no, you've given me the background. I just want to clarify one thing, because you said that the distress part would take place in the stomach acid. One of our worries is that what has material that's been presented to us is that when the jewelry itself has been distressed by the child chewing on it or deciding to bang it and make it into something else. And, you know, routinely if you see a little kid with jewelry that goes in the mouth and they chew or they suck or they play with it, that when that happens, the cadmium sheds in a larger quantity. So that then it's not just the stomach acid that's distressing, it's already... there's already a predilection to shed because of what's been done to it. So, you know, it becomes a very complex story. And I think what you have very much clarified, because I really didn't understand that it was the stomach that grinds it, and that it's actually the small bowel where we could have the absorption problem from when the stomach gets done with it. So yeah. That's very interesting.
Yeah, that's to me. Pretty much the story of any compound.
Yeah, well, you know, and I'm an economist. What can I say? Maybe I should know that.
Yeah, help me with my investing.
And I'll turn this back to the chair. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you. I'm going to just ask a few questions as well. When you were asked about the differences between a child's body and an adult body, would the diagram that you showed us of a typical stomach, would that be changed in a child? In other words, would there be less curves or more curves or any significant differences, or is it all the same at that point?
I guess the short answer is it's pretty much the same. There are some subtle small differences, but the hang-up points are the same. Remember I mentioned that the terminal ileum is a little bit bigger hang-up point for children.
Right.
But the other, but the anatomy and the C loop concerns and the pylorus concerns are pretty much the same.
You also indicated that some of this is influenced by what the diet or the food was that somebody ate before ingesting this foreign body. Once somebody ingests it and they realize it and they're taken to a medical facility, is it a protocol to administer liquids or other kinds of agents that might help expel this foreign body, or does it not work like that?
Usually not. Two sort of corollaries to that. As I mentioned, when the food gets stuck in the lower esophagus, you know, the porterhouse steak syndrome, or some food gets stuck in the lower esophagus, and we know it's food, and you know, I took too big a bite. Sometimes we give a compound called glucagon, or even something to relax the esophagus, like Valium, to let it fall into the stomach, and then try not to intervene. So that we'll do at a health center. I think the majority of the other things is we just kind of watchfully wait for them, but you know, identify what they are and make sure they're not getting hung up. Because sometimes the story you get and what actually you see is not 100% correct. And then the other concern is where we don't do any cathartics or anything is the body packers. There's plenty of evidence to show that it's not useful to give someone a laxative to try to purge something through the colon. It's not a smart thing to do.
Because on a personal level, I had a family member who he was older and had an esophagus issue, and we took him to UPenn on several occasions. And I do remember, now that you mentioned it, that something like Valium was given to relax it. And I also remember they gave him soda and asked him, if he could, to drink, whether... or not that was to kind of try and wash it, or there was another purpose for that. I do remember that being given to him, and if on some of the occasions he was able to drink it.
Yeah. You know, with the esophageal foreign bodies, one of the things you worry about is whether they can handle saliva secretions. And sometimes, especially in the elderly, they don't have a sensation of when the thing has passed. So sometimes we have them drink a little ginger ale. The bubbles might help it pass, you know, might create a positive pressure in the esophagus to help it sort of force it down. So that's one of the thinking behind it. And the other thinking behind it is it'll tell us or give us a little guideline whether or not it has passed because it doesn't come up. You know, and we're using it almost as a provocative test, I guess. Oh, he can handle, you know, fluids now, so it's probably passed. Because you know, our radiographs, without doing a dedicated endoscopy, our radiographs are not 100% accurate in diagnosing whether something's there or not. So we're kind of using that as a provocative test.
Also, I think you mentioned in your presentation that if something is lodged for 10 days or so, then you would go to the next step of, you know, introducing one of the procedures. But if a small child was taken to UConn and the parent identified the fact that they swallowed a battery or jewelry or whatever, and you know there was a risk of toxicity, would you then perform the procedure right away, or do you still have a protocol of waiting a certain number of days?
Every case is different, you know, and it's a judgment call. But a battery, I wouldn't wait, okay? And now it sounds like I wouldn't wait with cadmium jewelry either. So I would say it depends on what they swallowed, you know, the size and the conformity and the texture of what it is. You know, I mentioned kids love to swallow coins. If it, you know, somehow, you know, a five-year-old got a quarter down into his stomach, I would just go get it. You know, if it's a penny, I might watch it.
My last question is, depending on where the foreign object is lodged, whether it's the esophagus or the stomach, I assume when you do an endoscopy, it only goes so far, perhaps maybe to the stomach, but if it passes from the stomach to the small intestine, then do you have to perform surgery, or do you do a colonoscopy, or how does that work?
Excellent point. I think that's a really good question.
I had to come up with one good one.
No, because our endoscope can go down into that C-loop, okay? And beyond that, we're talking in the realm of surgery, you know? We can pick it up at the other end in the colonoscopy in some of that terminal ileum, that small bowel area, but that's only if it's been prepped and there isn't stool there to get there. So, yeah, we have a limited range that we can do the upper endoscopy on, just a little bit beyond that ceiling. Now, there are these things called balloon enteroscopies that can go way down into the small bowel and to retrieve things, but they're pretty laborious and pretty challenging and not widely available. It's a service I'm trying to get going at UConn because it's just not a widely available service. So,
I'm just not sure. When you said the endoscopy can go to a certain point, you're either using a term that I'm not sure what it is, or I'm not hearing you.
It can go a little bit beyond the stomach.
Stomach, okay.
Yeah, a little farther down. I could show you on the... Oops. It can go maybe right... It can go down the esophagus, down the stomach, around the C-loop, and maybe like somewhere down in here. About that far. Okay, now there's this, like I mentioned, this thing called balloon enteroscopy that can get down further. It's not widely available. We're trying to introduce it at UConn, and I know Yale's trying to introduce it too. But it isn't here widely. Like I said, it's not.
So, again, if it went too far down and there was no other way to get it, you would have to do surgery.
Right, and button batteries, not often, but... have that one of the indications where, you know, universal agreement, ER physician, surgeon, gastroenterologist, would all sort of agree that that's something that you would bring in a pediatric surgeon to take out.
Of the cases that you work on or that are done at UConn, mm-hmm. do you have any idea of what the percentage is that, number one, may pass naturally to require, let's say, something more simple like an endoscopy or three, require surgery?
Surgery, extremely rare. Passing, less common than what I reported to you. They tend to get stuck up, so I would say the largest majority is hung up in the esophagus or stomach, and we go in and retrieve them. That's my most common scenario, I would say. Occasionally, there'll be something stuck in the colon. Interestingly, my most recent case was a denture was stuck in the colon. I got that far, and then for somehow on the right side of the colon, right here, right in here, it just was kind of bouncing around and wouldn't come out.
Denture. Thank you. I don't think we want to see a picture of that. Okay. So let me start on this side, to my left. Anyone like to begin with questions?
One quick question. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Sure. Thanks for coming.
So in the situation of a child, would the procedures be the same as well, like what you described, endoscopy, potentially colonoscopy, and surgery? Or
yes.
Do you go straight to surgery, or is there another?
No, it's valid. It's good. It's the same procedure, littler scopes.
So are the risks of endoscopy or colonoscopy higher in a child?
You know, over the years, it's come up a lot. I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. I think the reason why that initially has been reported because the people, you know, there are pediatric gastroenterologists, mm-hmm. and they tend to, you know, be in the office a little more, and they tend to be a little bit more nervous about doing endoscopies. But as they've gotten more proficient and as we've gotten more proficient with children, I think that the actual risk is about the same.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Okay, I'll jump over to this side. Do you want to? I'm going to bounce back and forth.
Okay. Thank you, Doctor. I enjoyed your presentation. You mentioned that one of the things that you would immediately go to surgery for would be to remove a toxic substance. And, of course, that's one thing that this committee has been wrestling with, determining what is a toxic substance. And you also correctly assessed that we were looking at an acute exposure, not something that was chronic, and you know, this would be a one-time event. So in the stomach, you were saying that it would get broken down. But, of course, it would only be absorbed. It would break down to what was, I guess that's what we're wrestling with, about whether a total content or whether a migration test is the proper way to determine the risk. So I wonder, could you comment on, you know, in other words, if you were to swallow a penny, the penny wouldn't be absorbed, but then some of what was on that penny would slough off, if you will. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think I sort of know, and I'm not a sort of metallurgist, so I don't know how well. I mean, the stomach has hydrochloric acid and has this grinding action. So things are the process or the function of the stomach is to digest things. So that's its purpose is to break stuff down. Now, it just so happens that, you know, some things are sort of more susceptible to breaking down than others. You know, obviously plastic being one where it isn't sort of, you know, the compounds in plastic aren't that easily absorbed or broken down by stomach acid. I know you guys are really sort of wrestling with the term of breaking down this children's jewelry, and then the other aspect of it is the absorption of it. And I think the breakdown point, what I can tell you is that I think that I don't know how much of it is going to be broken down in any given scenario. What I can say is that if it's a smaller piece, the likelihood of a long-term exposure is not that high. So that the transit time of it is not an issue. How much of a transit time or how much exposure deems too much is something that, you know, you guys have to sort of decide. And I'm not sure if you've had all this sort of data on that. It seems like I'm not sure. I mean, how much exposure of how much cadmium is considered too much? You know, you can say that, well, I'm manufacturing this cadmium with this much in it. Well, with that much cadmium in it, how long does it take for you to get a reasonable level in your bloodstream? And that I can't answer you, but that is one of your questions, for sure. Yes, I can tell you that things pass through the GI tract, you know, in a day or two, normally, and you have to sort of do that assumption. But then the question is, well, a piece of cadmium-laced jewelry, children's jewelry that has distress, how much is that actually being released into the system? And I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that.
And again, we're also challenged dealing with such tiny numbers. I mean, we're dealing with numbers of 75 parts per million or 300 parts per million. They're tiny numbers at best. And thank you for that answer. But of course, we could assume that in order for something to be absorbed, it would have to be there. And so again, that's what we have to determine as a committee. One other question: have you had any experience with magnets being ingested?
Yes, magnets also have to come out. Good point.
And
yes. Same reason.
Yes, and what is the frequency of magnets?
Magnets are you don't see them in as much as toys as you used to, and so I don't. I would say earlier in my career, 90s. Yes, I'll admit it. I've been around a while. Earlier in my career, I saw some magnets, and I haven't seen them more recently. The pattern of things that get ingested change over time. Like, I don't think kids play with marbles as much anymore. I don't see marbles as much as button batteries, because button batteries are in all electronic devices. So you see more batteries now and less marbles.
Great. Well, thank you.
Yeah. We'll pop over back to my left. Barry.
Hi, thank you for that presentation. What is the pH of the esophagus?
The esophagus probably has a fairly acidic pH, but the way it's quoted is it normally is above 4.
Oh, okay.
So. Not stomach, you're saying esophagus, right? Did you want the stomach or the
esophagus? No. I'm going to talk about the stomach next, but since materials may be, or jewelry may be lodged either in the esophagus or in the stomach, or elsewhere, I suppose, but the places I think we're mostly concerned about is where the pH may be on the acidic side.
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds like it would be the esophagus or the stomach. And in your mind, things in either place could be lodged for significant numbers of days, like something like a piece of toy jewelry?
I think I was mentioning before, in the esophagus, you're usually quite symptomatic, including children. Mm-hmm. And so I think there, someone would recognize the distress and that would be quickly eliminated. I think in the stomach, if it goes unrecorded and, when moms blame dads and dads blame mom, which I've seen. but when that happens, sitting in the stomach could be a while. Yeah, as I mentioned.
Would something the size of a penny be noticed in the esophagus?
Yes. If it got lodged in a child, yes.
Are there anatomical or pathological conditions of the stomach which would tend to retard migration out of the stomach from something lodged? Are there crypts, folds, things that can be worsened?
In the stomach, I would say, as a general rule, no, for children. For adults, the big thing is that as you start taking a lot of medications, they can slow down your transit time and slow down your gut motility. Pain meds, opioids, can do that quite a bit. Just like it can give you constipation, it can slow down your transit time in your stomach quite a bit. And the other compound or substance that could slow down is if you have diabetes. Diabetes slows down your stomach. But those aren't generally things that involve children. So I would say for children, it's the anatomical issue in stomach are not that significant. Yes, they're diverticulums of the stomach. There's malrotation of the stomach. But these are all big problems that are well known. And, they wouldn't be subtle, undiagnosed.
Yeah, I don't know if you know the toxicology of cadmium at all, but do metals tend to affect the motility of the GI tract? Would it affect the stomach's ability to pass material through some kind of local toxic action?
Not to my knowledge. I haven't seen that. Yeah, but going back to the other representative about the Japanese who haven't studied a bit, I don't remember reading that as one of the problems. Constipation or...
If I can, one more question. Do you have an opinion, or could you formulate an opinion about the type of in vitro testing that is done to try to simulate the gastric contents, which is 0.07 normal HCl with some agitation for 24 hours?
I think it's a reasonable test, but I think for me, then I would like to know, that's a reasonable test to see what the, not the absorption, that's really kind of the
extraction.
Yeah, the extraction. What I'd like to know is then, does someone have any data on the actual absorption? And once it's extracted, do we know what, how much cadmium exposed at what level in the small bowel gets absorbed? Or even gets absorbed through tissue. I don't know. That to me, that's the other part of the equation that I don't know. I mean, I think that's a reasonably, from the industry piece, I think that's a reasonably valid test to say of, the I won't call it the trauma, but the beat up of it. But now the second part of this is, okay, now how germane is that to how much you're really absorbing of this? I mean, in a 2 or 3 day time frame, how much is really out there and how quickly can cadmium really be absorbed. Cadmium might be very slowly absorbed. I'm not sure. I really don't know.
But getting back to the extractability of it, so I know that gastric pH can go up and down. Is 0.07 normal pretty much as acidic as it gets?
Yeah. You have to assume that in the stomach is a sterile environment and the pH is less than 1, as an old professor told me once. It's very acidic.
And pH of 1 is what normality?
I don't remember. My high school chemistry. Huh?
Thank you. Let's do first questions first before we go back. Okay, we'll go back.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Doctor, thank you for being here.
Sure.
I know how important it is to be able to take a day away from what you do at UConn and share it with us, and I wish more people would do that, so thank you. One of the questions I had was...
it's my pleasure.
It's our pleasure, trust me. One of the questions I had is once something has been exposed to acid in the stomach and it moves through the small intestine or it's in the small intestine, at that point, how acidic is the small intestine? Is it already been taken care of by the stomach or...
I was talking to Joanne or Senator representatives here. It's a gradated thing. The proximal small bowel, the C loop, is almost as acidic as the stomach. It goes from like a pH of 2 to 4, and then by the time you get to the bottom of the stomach, you're down to normal acid base balance of a pH of 7 or 8. So it's gradated. Depending on where you are, because as the stomach gets as the stomach acid and its contents get dumped into the small bowel, slowly the acid is buffered and neutralized from the pancreas here, secreting bicarbonate to neutralize it.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts off pretty high pH, 2-ish, and then it drops by the time it gets down to the terminal ileum to more like 7.5-8. So it goes from acid to almost alkaline.
So it would be fair to say that once it's in the stomach, if 80% or so of it of the stomach empties in a couple hours, probably 4 hours total, if everything goes okay and it doesn't get caught up, it's going to be exposed to high acid probably for half that.
Yeah.
In the big, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's relatively correct. Yeah, not a long term. No.
And you had mentioned earlier we're talking about at some point you go through endoscopy and you remove items. With children in mind, how often are you removing things from the stomach versus the small intestine?
Stomach more.
And it's quarters, batteries?
Quarters, batteries, and because that's where they tend to, there's that fixed point of the pylorus, which is significantly more smaller than the fixed point of your esophagus. So a child can get it down his esophagus. It's more the adults who get things stuck in the esophagus. Mm-hmm. The child can get it down the esophagus, but he gets it stuck in the stomach.
And in a lot of those cases, would you say that it was identified pretty quickly that they had swallowed something? Or do you come in, how often has it happened that it's been there for 10 days plus?
I thought I'd hear this question sooner. Interesting. I go back through the literature, and I don't think it's well documented because there's such a small end, as someone mentioned here. Is that I think that in children it's not as well reported as adults, But I think the foreign body ingestion by children that goes unreported is a lot higher than you realize. With that corollary, right. Most of it just passes in a day or two, and nobody cares.
Right.
You know.
Okay.
So I mean, when they say that it's the people that present to an ER at UConn, you know, what percentage that presents there, is not, it, you know, child foreign body ingestion is not that common. Not that common. You know, 20 years, something like that. And let's just take a number. That's pretty close to the real number, by the way. How many are out there in the community that just pass spontaneous? My guess is it's not even a factor of 10. I mean, it could be a factor of 100, you know, much bigger. So I think that goes on a lot more commonly.
Well, that's very helpful because, you know, really what we're trying to get to the bottom of is what kind of tests we use for cadmium in jewelry. Is it something where it should be exposed to acid a very, very long time? And is that legitimate? Should the piece be distressed, you know, broken before it goes in? I mean, those are all these questions, and I think this is very helpful in answering that. The last thing, you mentioned about 1,500 people per year are fatalities due to ingesting something. Could you characterize what usually happens in those cases?
Yeah, the largest majority of them is that they went unnoticed, okay, and that they had caused perforation. And the perforation is, you know, in the abdominal catastrophe, and the, you know, mortality rate of that is significant. You know, you get peritonitis, you get infection in your peritoneum, in your abdominal wall, and that doesn't always clear up. And that's the most, that's the number one reason why you can get that. You could also develop bleeding from something. You could get, you know, erosion of tissue. You could develop a quick bleed, and the bleed could, you know, cause exsanguination and death in someone before you could really get into medical care. That's kind of the secondary one. I have not seen a perforation present, a foreign body present as a perforation de novo except esophageal in my time.
So you're saying that most of them are esophageal perforations? Is it?
I think a lot of the deaths are esophageal. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Doctor, thank you very much for your time today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anybody who hasn't asked a question yet? Okay, so why don't we go for seconds, and let me start with my coach here. Do you want to ask anything now? No. Okay, we'll do the same order. Anything on this side of the table?
Just a point to be perfectly clear about the time frames we're talking about. So it sounded like 80% of what gets into the stomach will be cleared on its own within a relatively short period of time, but of the remaining 20%, which could be a child's piece of jewelry, that there is going to be significantly longer amounts of time, potentially on the order of several days. I would just like you to say whether you think that that's accurate, or what's the best way to portray that, what happens to that other 20%?
It's a pretty good question. This is the sort of thing that the way I would sort of answer that from my perspective is that when I put down that 80%, that meant a meal. Okay, that a meal is 50% of the time is emptied in the stomach in the first hour, and 80-90% after 2 hours. Okay, it's half order kinetics. So then the 20% or 25% remaining, you know, after 2 hours, then 12% of that is the next hour, and then 12% is that. It's the only corollary to that, sir, is that those things that are outliers, you know, the things that are too big or the things that are too long might take prolonged. But other than that, I would expect the stomach to be, you know, completely empty in 4 hours in almost everybody.
So I obviously asked the question wrong, but I'm not sure what the right way to ask the question is. For something that's not food, that looks like a coin or looks like a piece of jewelry that may get through the pyloric sphincter on its own but may get hung up, what is in your mind is how long it could get hung up without surgical or endoscopic intervention?
There again, it depends on what it is, and you know, the conformity, and you know, the toxicity risk is just because we're not our tolerance of letting it sit there. But the compound itself, what it is, I would expect it to have pretty normal emptying kinetics compared to regular food. So yes, I would still expect that. In other words, I think what you're asking is, if someone put a button and the button sat in the stomach, how fast would I expect the button to leave? And I think the answer to that is, yeah, I'd expect the button, about 80% of the buttons that are less than 2.5 centimeters, to be out of the stomach in 2 hours. I mean, that's what I would expect. Most compounds that are small enough to pass do pass pretty much the same as food substances.
But if something's on the order of the size of a quarter, then I think you said quarters have trouble passing.
Yes, quarters have trouble passing, and quarters might not even pass, and therefore I wouldn't follow it to see when it would pass. I would just take it out. You know, anything bigger than 2.5 centimeters, I would just take out based on the size of that. The size criteria is too large.
And because it's just not going to clear on its own. So we're talking on the
risk is that it might clear on its own, but it might not.
It might be several days or
exactly
or an extended
exactly.
period of time.
Right. Okay. Exactly.
Okay. We'll jump over here. Yeah.
Thank you, Doctor. I just want to walk you through that again, if you don't mind. I'm a father of 4 girls. They're grown now, but when they were younger, they would probably have this type of costume jewelry. So let me walk you through a scenario. One of them swallows the costume jewelry, comes to her mother and I and says, "I just swallowed this." There's one of two things that are going to happen. Number one, it's going to get stuck. I'm going to rush her to the emergency room. You're going to take it out. Or she's going to swallow it. It's going to sit in her stomach for, this is where I'm not sure. What happened? Up to 4 hours, you think? It's going to sit there until it passes.
Correct.
And if it doesn't, she'll have pain, or she'll have some sort of symptoms that will.
She may not have symptoms.
She may not have.
I would say the majority of people who have a foreign body in their stomach would not have symptoms. Like I said, if it doesn't make the size criteria, length or width.
Yep.
I would expect it to pass as normal food substances pass through the entire GI tract in 1 to 2 days.
In 1 to 2 days.
Okay.
Okay. So that gets back to your point earlier then, where you said, I think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but basically that you didn't think you were really qualified to determine whether or not the level of toxicity in that toy was harmful or not.
Right. Yes. Yeah,
you didn't think you were qualified for that.
I really don't think
yeah,
that.
Very fair. But you also said earlier that the case that Representative Urban had talked about in Japan, I think, was that the Japanese had cadmium in everything.
Yeah.
Can you just explain that and the difference between them, how they cadmium is used in Japan and how it is used here?
I'm not sure where, but somehow in Japan it's contaminated in the fact that they're constantly exposed to it from their food supplies is infected with it.
Okay.
And I'm not sure what the thing is. I believe it's the rice, but I'd have to go back and look. But it's something in their food supply that has created this chain of constant exposure and toxicity.
Right.
And well described.
Right. And obviously, we don't have that.
No.
Right.
No. But that's also, on that case, it's a chronic long-term exposure, and I'm not even sure how much levels are in these substances that they're ingesting.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes. Right.
And, of course, we've heard a lot of testimony about that. But we've been discussing about how something that would be normally swallowed and would move through the stomach in a period of a matter of hours, and then some things would get stuck. In your career, how often has that happened? Have you performed surgery for something that got stuck?
Surgery or endoscopy?
Surgery.
Surgery is quite rare. Okay. Surgery, all foreign body ingested, the literature will tell you it's 1% of all foreign body ingestions. Okay. I would say the number is even a little less than that.
Okay.
Based on my own personal experience, surgery. The endoscopy is, like, especially with the esophageal stuff, it's a reasonable number.
So you've done 50 of them? Or?
Oh, more.
Oh, more.
Oh, yeah.
Hundreds.
Hundreds, yeah, maybe.
And would those be for those things that were above the 2.5 millimeters, something the size of a quarter, and something that was 3 inches long?
No, some of it's food bolus, okay? I would say the number one thing is the food bolus thing stuck in the distal esophagus. Oh. Then, you know, stuff stuck up here. I remember once, I'm doing anecdotes here, psych patients swallowed one of those double-edged razor blades and it got stuck up in the upper esophagus. Story of a guy, this. Remember when these caps used to be bigger? The guy was going like this in his car and he would swallow the cap and then start drinking the water because he didn't want to take his hands off the wheel. Yeah, there's lots of stories.
You know, I just don't have the stomach to do your job. Anyway, you also brought up a very, sorry for the pun, but you also brought up a very good thing, that even though something would migrate, you know, how much of it would be absorbed. And, you know, it's interesting to note, though, that the CPSC determined when they recommended the 24-hour heated agitated test that they were to assume 100% absorption, and they found a level of 200 micrograms as being a safe acute exposure. Would you comment on that level?
It's interesting that that you have that sort of statistic.
For a 40-pound child.
Yeah, so 200 microgram absorption in 24 hours.
Correct.
So you would have to assume, and what's considered a toxic level? Do we know?
Well, they were considering that to be the toxic. Well, they were considering that to be wildly health protective. I think it's a scientific multiple. It's either 4 or 10 or something that they use to calculate that.
Oh, I see, the 200.
Yes, to get to the 200.
And that would be exposure to something in 24 hours? I didn't quite get your whole...
Okay, the test is a 24-hour heated agitated test. So
right.
They would get the hydrochloric acid, put the component part of the piece of jewelry in it. That would get heated agitated for 24 hours, and they would then measure the amount of cadmium. If it was less than 200 micrograms, they
measured in what?
Safe.
In the gel around it, or where they measured?
In the fluid, in the hydrochloric acid that they had, the simulated 0.7 HCl.
Yeah. Okay. And what levels did they get when they did that?
Well, of course, they were getting many that were non-detect, but they were so small. But they were saying that anything less than 200 was safe.
Gotcha. All right. So you have indirect. So even if you assume 100% absorption of this compound breaking down,
correct,
you would get nowhere near the 200 because in your fluid it's under what level? It's zero, undetectable, or what was in the fluid?
Well, they were testing pieces of jewelry, that might have had 300 ppm, 800 ppm total content.
And how much was in the fluid after the 24-hour test?
It, again, varied, but they determined that 200 micrograms would
be the
limit.
What they determined, what did
right.
they find?
Right. They found much less, and they found, I think, a few.
Well, what was that number? Do we know? Or?
It was a variety.
All right. Yeah. I guess that's my point. I mean, I can tell you it's a day or two exposure time, and then you have to sort of extrapolate, well, how much is that actually level of how much you're actually getting in?
Good. Thank you.
Yeah.
We're going to take one more question here, and then Representative Urban has a question. Follow the day after that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just need to get at the fallacy of that last question, which was, I think, an unfair question, because the way the 200 micrograms is understood is to be absorbed at the same rate, 100% of the same rate that comes from the toxicology, which is an epidemiology study, so that the allowable dose is not an absorbed dose, but it's an exposure dose. And so we're allowing, by this extraction method, and not an absorbed dose, but an exposure dose, which is an apples to apples to the epidemiology. Nobody knows what the percentage of absorbed dose was in an epidemiology, but we have a good idea of what the exposure dose was. So we're just saying we don't want any more exposure than the toxic level in the epidemiology study, which, again, is not an absorbed dose, but it's an exposure dose.
Up with
thank you. thank you, Mr. Chairman. It occurred to me that when you're talking about the 2.5 centimeters, that's the same for a child's body. Are the passages in a child's body are the same as an adult? So the 2.5 centimeters is fine.
It's very similar. It depends on the sort of the age of the child, but honestly, that point starts at about age 3. And then people say, well, you know, between the ages of 3 to 6, maybe we should think more in the terms of 2 centimeters, but it's pretty much the same. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. And then I think my final question, and maybe this is not a fair question for you, and if it's not, then just let me know. I'm concerned when Dr. Bruckner came in and pointed out to us that the half-life of cadmium is 30 years.
Impressive.
So if a child ingests cadmium and absorbs it, yeah, then presumably it's within that child's system for 30 years. Are they able to, if the science that we have listened to, which is when the jewelry has been chewed on or banged around, the cadmium sheds much more rapidly than when it's not been chewed on or banged on. The small intestine is where you're telling me that piece of cadmium would get in the stomach, there'd be more distress because it's ground up and the hydrochloric acid goes after it. How do you have any expertise or knowledge of, once it gets to that small intestine, the absorption rate in the small intestine?
I don't.
Okay.
I know. Yes, it's one of my questions that came to my mind, but I don't actually know it.
Okay. No. I appreciate that. So that would be a question for the record, please, so that we can find out exactly what that absorption rate is in the small intestine. We, Doctor, we do questions for the record so that we can do the research and actually find out. So I really appreciate your saying that's not your area, so, you know, we can go out. Because you, in your presentation, were able to raise that question. Before I heard you, I didn't even know that I needed to know that question. So I really appreciate what you've brought forth here today. Thank you.
I think it's another variable.
My finger keeps hitting the wrong button here. I'm out of practice. I want to thank Dr. Burke for taking the time and coming before us. This was very, very helpful. And I would remind members that Dr. Burke, by his own introduction, shared expertise based upon how items may pass through our body, how they may get lodged, how they get extracted once they go to a medical facility. But there were some questions at the end from parties on both sides of the issue about toxicity and chemistry that I think the doctor indicated he does not have the expertise to answer. So I think I would hope that members would leave today with the information that he did give us related to his expertise, and I think that was extremely helpful. So I want to thank you and thank University of Connecticut for sharing you with us, and this was very helpful. Representative Carter?
Thank you for recognizing, Mr. Chairman. It might be helpful to ask the doctor if he has any recommendations where we might find that information. Like, where would we, who would we turn to in the medical community to talk about absorption rate with respect to the small intestine? Thank you.
That's an excellent suggestion. And perhaps you could get back to either the co-chairs or our clerks to give us any information. And perhaps there's somebody at UConn. Again, I wasn't here the last meeting, but there may be some others in addition that can give us that information
I'm not convinced that we need to know that answer, as the conversation that we were having a few minutes ago, that it's already taken into account in the CPSC's risk assessment when they came up with the 200. And so the percent absorption, whatever that is from jewelry, I mean, unless we could find a scientist who's going to say that the absorption rate from cadmium extracted out of a piece of jewelry is going to be different than the cadmium uptake rate from rice, then it doesn't matter, because we already know the dose response and the toxicity for cadmium hitting the small intestine, whatever that absorption rate was in the epi studies. So we're assuming that's the same rate in a child. It could be wrong. Children may absorb metals more aggressively or less so than adults, depending upon nutritional deficits, other various factors that I don't know that we want to go too far down that road. But that's where I think it would make a difference, is if the scenario we're looking at is different than the EPI, but CPSC seemed to be the same. And I think that's the easiest first approximation, is that it is the same. We have dose response data in humans for cadmium from ingestion from their diet. We're assuming it's the same rate of absorption from this scenario, so we don't have to get in the weeds. My opinion is we don't have to get into the weeds on this.
Well, again, we can discuss that. If anybody on the task force has suggestions, or the doctor thinks after hearing this little colloquy that you can help us and steer us towards somebody, we'll consider it. If we don't have any other suggested witnesses to testify, then we will come back when we meet again, hopefully in middle, late November, with some recommendations on how to proceed in terms of our own dialogue and decision-making. Once again, I want to thank everybody for coming. I hope the clerks took attendance and you know who's here, who's not. And once again, I wish all of you a good month or so before we get together again. And if there's anything you want to pass on to the co-chairs, in terms of suggestions or ideas, feel free to do that. So with that, we will adjourn this afternoon's task force meeting. And once again, Dr. Burke, thank you very much.